Here's a friendly suggestion. Those beautiful views deserve some new frames. Custom designs and superior service make getting new windows a work of art. A free, no-pressure renewal by Andersen consultation is just a call or click away. When it's time to talk windows, we'll bring the wisdom. Renewal by Andersen.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's one question in Brian Koberger's case that has a grip on anyone who's followed this story closely. One that doesn't fade even after the arrest, the conviction, and the life sentence. It's not about the timeline. It's not about the DNA or the knife sheath. It's about the things we haven't found. The K-bar knife. The clothing he wore that night, the things you'd expect to turn up in an investigation of this magnitude, but never did. And the longer they remain missing, the more the mind wanders to where they might be. And what that says about the man who took them out of that house and into the dark. In recent weeks, speculations picked up again, sparked in part by our own Robin Drake, who floated the possibility that Koberger could have had his own version of a BTK-style hidey hole or a buried stash cache of evidence, weapons, or trophies. It's not a stretch if you know your criminal history. BTK had them. Israel Keyes had them. Ted Bundy, in his own way, had them and held on to items that tethered him back to his crimes. For some offenders, returning to those items isn't nostalgia. It's part of the fantasy loop. And when you consider that Koberger's documented movements after the murders included detours to parks and wooded areas, it makes you wonder if that same loop was running in his head. And then there's the matter of the IDs, not in a glove box, as earlier reports had it, but inside a glove in a box at his parents' house. At least 2 IDs, both belonging to women who weren't among the Idaho 4. But according to the FBI property receipt, there weren't just 2, there were 10. 10 IDs, 8 of which have never been publicly discussed. The official explanation, there isn't one, at least not yet. So we're left asking the obvious, who did they belong to? Why did he have them? And why are we only hearing about 2? It's the intersection, the missing weapon, the buried or hidden trophies, and the unexplained cache of IDs that's worth slowing down for, because each of those elements on its own is troubling. Together, they might tell us more about what Brian Koberger was doing before the murders, what he kept after them, and what parts of the story are still buried, maybe literally. Somewhere out there. So let's dig into it. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, joining us to dig into all of this. You've been very vocal about your own theory from the very beginning. You've said you never believed he ditched the knife or the clothing, given what we now know about his movements and what's turned up in searches. How plausible is it to you that Koberger had his own hidden cache? What do you make of these IDs?
You know, Tony, from the beginning, supposition on my part was that, and in part based on the shovel, was that certainly I believe he kept the bloody clothing, the K-bar knife. I never thought he threw it in the river or anything like that. And this is why. Mm-hmm. When you look at BTK, when you look at Ted Bundy, to return to the items that were used would be so stimulating. And of course, you know, this crime was a crime of sexual fantasy. Mm-hmm. We now know some of his searches, and what seemingly excited him was sex with bodies that were unconscious, sex with bodies that were completely compliant, and sex with people drunk, passed out. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that he would have kept the items as well. I think he would have used that shovel to dig, possibly. And that's why law enforcement took so many pains to try to find the dirt and try to match it up with what was on the shovel from all the different sites he stopped at, mm-hmm. according to his digital trail. So do I think he had an actual hidey hole that he dug before the murders? I think it could be possible, mm-hmm. But certainly I don't think he ditched anything. I think they're somewhere.
Yeah, that's the question. And would there be any incentive for Brian Koberger to reveal that information anymore today? Or do you think that might be something that is going to be locked away with him behind those bars?
I think someday, Tony, he's going to meet with somebody. This, I think, will fulfill the fantasy he's in now. Mm-hmm. He would love to be renowned, if you will. He would love to be a Ted Bundy or BTK. Actually, he's already reached that height, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody in true crime, certainly that follows news, anyone that's paying attention knows his name and knows what happened to those mm-hmm. Idaho Four to some degree. And sure. So... what infamy for him, that he would have if books are written about him, but he's got to dangle some carrots out there. And one of those carrots, I think, is where is that K-bar knife and the clothing?
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to see if we do ever get our hands on it. I'm wondering, I mean, they did find, we'll go to the IDs for a moment, the IDs in a glove, in a box of Koberger at his parents' home in Idaho. I know earlier reports, including here, we have been saying in a glove box, because that's really what it appeared when you look at it, but in a glove, in a box at his parents' home, doesn't necessarily change up the conversation all that much. He still had the IDs in a glove, in a box. So go from there. What does that tell us about him at all? And I'm wondering if there's going to be other things, other IDs hidden somewhere, other trophies. It seems odd that there's just the two of them there. And I'm wondering if there would be some things even more precious to him, if you would, that might be under the ground somewhere in one of these hidey holes, which dirt was still on his shovel from.
Well, the interesting part of those IDs, of course, are there are other females that he worked with far mm-hmm. back.
Yeah.
So, he would have confiscated those, Tony, right?
Yeah.
He made the effort to have them. And I think that's part of the fantasy. And were they ever on his radar? I tell you, it seems like they were. He kept them. And mm-hmm. that was for a reason. What troubles me is if you look back at that search warrant return, it specifically says the number 10. 10 IDs in a glove in a box. Mm-hmm. And again, to put IDs in a glove, why? Other than you're hiding something mm-hmm. and in that box, right, that they found. So yeah. I always figured that they would be something interesting. But what about the other 8 IDs? And I think this goes back to our premise, right? He wanted to keep items that he could go back to and fantasize about.
Why are we only hearing about the 2 IDs? The information's coming out now. What would be the holdback on the other 8 being revealed? Because originally, yes, it did say 10. Are they saying that there's only 2 now? What's going on there?
Well, that's what bothers me, because there's a big disconnect. Mm-hmm. The FBI FB-597 clearly states 10 IDs. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't make any sense that only 2 are being discussed. Hopefully more will come out on that. I want to hear about the other 8.
Yeah, I certainly do too, because I mean, initially the early reporting had said that's not related to the King Road House. Obviously, the 2 that came out were not related to the King Road House. But I do wonder, I mean, there really hasn't been even any recognition that there are 8 more. It's just simply we found 2 IDs. That seems to be the way it's being stated right now, correct?
That's correct. And I'm confused about that. At least what they're talking mm-hmm. about are the 2 IDs. But I specifically pulled that FD-597 up mm-hmm. And pretty much toward the top of that, you can see 10, you know, 1, 0. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's not 2 or 10. It's right there. This agent didn't have the best handwriting,
yeah.
But certainly you can see it says 10 IDs. So yeah. What happened to the other 8? Why aren't they being discussed? And I always say, you know, in these cases like this, there's so much information that becomes fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are almost 3 years away. In November, it'll be 3 years. And Tony, sometimes the people that are being interviewed, for instance, that discussed those mm-hmm. 2 IDs, were those the only 2 IDs that they recall being significant? Because it's super significant,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, that they were from his previous female coworkers, from as far back as, you know, when he was working at the school.
Yeah.
In Pennsylvania. So that's very significant. And maybe they didn't mention the others, but you should mention the others. And that paperwork will come out,
yeah,
I think.
I'm wondering about that. I mean, why would you not mention the others? And I guess perspective is another benefit that we have now, because it's all this time later. They may not have thought them to be significant at the time, but I think Koberger in possession of anybody's IDs is significant. To wonder, what was that all about? How did he have them? Why did he have them? Were they other ones his IDs? I mean, we I guess don't technically know the answer to it. We know there were IDs. I highly doubt he had 8 versions of his own ID. But yeah, why? And will that come out? Could that come out? Who needs to be shooken a little bit to get that information to fall from that tree?
Well, we still have so little,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you look at quote unquote terabytes of information, we're not seeing terabytes of information. We're seeing hundreds of pages, which is, you know,
not
so
much.
Little.
Yeah.
It's minuscule compared to everything that's out there. And then we're getting interviews about a lot of this. For instance, the 2 IDs, we haven't seen those IDs.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a document about those IDs. What we saw was an interview on the ID. So it's kind of like you're just constantly having to go back and look and scrub, and there's so much to read. And most of it, some of it's just so routine.
Mm-hmm.
Documentary-wise, it doesn't give us anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then some is kind of interesting.
Yeah. No, it certainly would be fascinating to see who is on those ideas. And I think it's going to create nightmares for whoever's IDs that he actually had. But I bet there's a lot of people who are looking back going, hey, I lost my ID around that time when I was interacting with Koberger. And I bet they probably know who they are. That would be fascinating to find out, you know, who and when and why, if anybody even wants to speak up. I don't blame them for not wanting to put their hat in the ring of this case. If they do ever find this knife, this K-bar knife, obviously he's in prison for the rest of his life. If it's found now, what sort of forensic value could it still have? I mean, could there be anything out of them? I'm guessing this man is cleanly as he tried to be, that there wouldn't be a whole lot left on this knife. Although who knows, if he thought nobody would find it, maybe there is for him to look back on in a dark, creepy way. Other than just the satisfaction of we found the knife, is there any value to retrieving it at this point?
There is always value, because even though I agree with you, he likely cleaned that thing inside and out. It's, you know, probably, devoid of any DNA or mm-hmm. biological information, but you never know. I've always said in that car that it would have been in the crevices or something found. And you know what? It wasn't, because he was that good. I mean, they talked about how he took the car apart and mm-hmm. put it back together. To make sure he cleaned, so no blood would have gotten in the creases, and probably prophylactically mm-hmm. put down something. I tell you, that's what I find just so interesting about this case, along with a lot of other things. But Tony, the way he was able to really cover up this crime is unbelievable. His cleanup process, I mean, I'm sorry to give him accolades for this, mm-hmm. but I just have to, because it was really good. And I've always said, I don't know if he would have been convicted. He mm-hmm. would have been arrested, but I don't know if he would have been convicted without the DNA on that sheath, because he did such a great job covering his tracks.
What Jennifer just laid out leaves us with a set of questions that don't shrink with time. They grow. If Koberger did have a hidey hole, whether dug before the murders or improvised on after, then someone out there could be the somewhere out there could be the physical remnants of that night. The K-bar, the clothing, maybe other trophies we haven't heard about. Items that for him might have been more than just evidence. They could have been touchstones for reliving what he did. That's not just a forensic theory, that's behavioral. And the IDs, that's the part that gnaws. The official record says 10, we've heard about 2. The rest are invisible in the public narrative. And that gap should bother anyone who thinks all the important facts are on the table. If 2 IDs from unrelated women are significant enough to discuss in interviews, how are the other 8 not? Are there 8 more? Was that a mess up on the original report? What's the story? Is it a matter of investigative sensitivity? Were they deemed irrelevant? Or is it just one of those case details that got lost in the shuffle of a massive evidence inventory? It's also worth noting, and Jennifer hinted at this, that not every detail in a case file is weighted the same at the time it's found. An ID from a woman he worked with in Pennsylvania might have seemed like a curiosity in the early days. 3 years later, it might look like a broader pattern. Perspective changes as more pieces fall into place, and sometimes those less important items take on a new shine when you put them out of the box and look at them in a different light. What sticks with me is that this conversation is happening almost 3 years after the murders. And we're still talking about big unknowns, a missing weapon, missing clothing, and an unexplained set of IDs. For a case that feels airtight in court, or at least we thought it would, it's surprisingly porous in the details. And that tells you something important about how these stories live on, not just in the middle and the minds of people who follow them, but in the dark corners of the evidence room, and maybe in the darker corners of the killer's own mind. So as we close out this segment, think about what we still don't know. Think about the facts that somewhere there might be a box or a buried container or a hidden space holding the answers to questions that still haunt this case, and ask yourself, if those items ever see daylight, what story will they tell? Will it be the one we've been told, or something we haven't even thought of yet? Let me know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not there already, check us out. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Of course, you can also do that same search wherever you get podcasts and find us there and take us on the go. Press subscribe wherever it is so you don't miss any of our coverage right here. And like I said, let me know your thoughts in the comments on YouTube. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.